This is BBC Radio 3. It's 4 o'clock. Coming up at 5:15, Stephen Johnson presents Discovering Music, looking at the original version of Stravinsky's Petrushka. But now, from the stage of the Royal Albert Hall here in London, here's Louise Fryer with today's First Prom.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Royal Albert Hall. I'm Louise Fryer and I'm from Radio 3. I'm presenting the prom for you this afternoon. It's the first of two proms. This evening, Sir Simon Rattle will be conducting the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment and a starry cast in Act Two of Tristan and Isolde by Wagner. And this afternoon, we're going to be hearing Wagner as perhaps you've never heard him before, arranged for the organ by Edwin Lemaire. When he was just 13, he won a scholarship to the Royal Academy of Music, and he went on to become one of the greatest organists of his generation in the first decades of the 20th century. Well, one of our own most celebrated organists, Wayne Marshall, is going to be playing the transcriptions, unleashing the mighty beast that is this organ where I'm standing. It was built by Henry Willis in 1871, and in those days was the largest organ in the world. Since it was remodeled in 2004 by Manders, it now has 147 stops and getting on for 10,000 pipes, which makes it perfect for conveying the full scope of Wagner's orchestrations. Wayne Marshall is going to begin by playing the overtures to two of Wagner's operas, Die Meistersinger and Tannhäuser. Then I'll be joining him up on the organ bench to find out a little bit more about the organist's art of improvisation before he goes on to play fast and free with themes from Tristan and Isolde, and then he'll end with another Wagnerian theme that needs no introduction. So let's welcome him now, Wayne Marshall, to begin this afternoon's prom with the overture to Die Meistersinger by Wagner. two overtures by Wagner, Die Meistersinger and Tannhäuser, Wayne Marshall performing here at the Royal Albert Hall. Now, Wayne, it's the first time that those transcriptions have been performed at the Proms. When did you first come across them?
Well, I came across these quite a long time ago because, as an organist, I always play transcriptions, and it's quite fun, of course, to play them. But these are very interesting transcriptions. I mean, Lemaire, of course, is a fantastic organist and a great transcriber. But I do find that some of them, I mean, particularly a lot of them, really, are very difficult to play.
You would say that.
Yeah, they're very difficult to play. And in some cases, a lot of them need modification. I mean, you know, you can imagine that all those different lines, particularly in the Tannhäuser overture there, the main theme. I mean, I was cheating a little bit because, in fact, my partner here was actually playing the main theme.
We'll make sure Jennifer takes a bow at the end.
Because, you know, I only have two hands, you see. This is the problem. But in any case, I mean, as a conductor, I'm always very interested in what the original score looks like, and this is one thing I did actually before I started to play these, is to look at the score, and then one has to sort of see exactly how one can actually adapt them for the organ and make them really work very well.
Now, next you're going to be doing your own improvisations on themes from Tristan. There's a very long-standing tradition of organists improvising in a way that would make many a classical musician absolutely terrified. What's its appeal for you?
Well, for me, it's about being creative and spontaneous. And, I mean, I think that an improvisation has to be interesting. It's wonderful to have a great organ to improvise on here at the Albert Hall. We've got a lot of colours and different sounds on it. And to have the themes which I think will also make an interesting piece.
How do you choose which themes to pick?
Well, it depends and it varies because, today I'm going to improvise on mainly two themes from Tristan and Isolde, and you'll recognize them anyway when you hear them. And I'm going to try and make, as I said, I always never know exactly what's going to happen, but looking at the time, there's about 30 minutes, but I'm not going to improvise for 30 minutes. But I can certainly make a piece, and I never know exactly until I sit down and do it, so I'll sit down and do it now.
Well, we shall expect the unexpected. Wayne Marshall, thank you very much. We'll leave you to improvise on themes from Wagner's Tristan and Isolde. Wayne Marshall playing The Ride of the Valkyries, composed by Wagner in the mid-1850s, transcribed for organ in 1899 by Edwin Lemaire. And before that, we heard Wayne Marshall improvising on themes from Wagner's Tristan and Isolde. Lemaire's aim was to raise the organ to what he regarded as its proper position as a solo instrument. For him, that meant using it for modern pieces audiences wanted to hear. And it sounds as though they still want to hear them today. He was very much making the most of the technical innovations organ builders of the day.
Thank you.
Wayne Marshall catching me out in his eagerness to return to the organ bench to add his own improvisations on Wagner's Valkyrie theme. A good improviser, they say, is like a storyteller adapting his tale for his audience, a spinner of yarns, knowing the plot and filling in the detail as he goes along. Well, Wayne Marshall certainly demonstrating those abilities in this prom, live from the Royal Albert Hall. He's appeared at the proms on many occasions. He made his conducting debut in Porgy and Bess in the Gershwin Centenary here. He was a soloist for the 1997 Last Night of the Proms. He gave the UK premiere of James McMillan's Organ Concerto in 2005, played it the first night in 2008, and he'll be conducting the Belfast Prom in the Park. Well, we'll be back for more Wagner at 6:30, but for the moment, that's all from the Royal Albert Hall. Jill Anderson is in Broadcasting House.
Thank you very much. That was Louise Fryer. Well, some of our proms are being repeated in Afternoon on 3. That's on weekdays at 2 o'clock. And all of them are available for 7 days on the BBC iPlayer. If you want to hear any, go to bbc.co.uk/iPlayer/radio. Choose Radio 3 and you'll see a list of programmes. Well, coming up next this afternoon, Discovering Music, and Stephen Johnson explores the original version of Stravinsky's Petrushka. That's at 5:15. So I thought we'd hear some music by Stravinsky now. Dumbarton Oaks was composed 26 years after Petrushka in 1937. It was named after a house in Washington, D.C., owned by Mr. and Mrs. Robert Woods Bliss, and it was composed for their 30th wedding anniversary. Here to play it is the Scottish Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Jukka-Pekka Saraste. Thank you.
Thank you.
Stravinsky's Dumbarton Oaks. Jukka-Pekka Saraste conducted the Scottish Chamber Orchestra. This is BBC Radio 3. It's 16 minutes past five. Time for Discovering Music and another chance to hear a programme first broadcast last year exploring one of Stravinsky's most popular ballets. Here's Stephen Johnson.
It's Shrovetide, the beginning of Lent in the old Tsarist Russia. A great annual fair is on. It's a popular fair. There may be the odd gentrified person slumming it a bit, but mostly it's the ordinary Russian people. It's a bright, clear day. I think you can hear that in the music. There's a suggestion of lively birdsong hovering above the texture on a flute. But also, it's early in the year, so it's probably pretty cold. Maybe you can get a suggestion of that too in the music. The freshness, the hard edges. At the same time, the air's beginning to fill with distinctive odours. The smell of horses, fried onions, tobacco, crowds pressed close together. Well, there's plenty of atmosphere there, but how is it conveyed? The music's full of what seem like pretty recognisable sound symbols. But the thing about sound symbols is they often tend to be vivid but ambiguous. Take that bird song I mentioned at the beginning. It could be bird song, but it could also just possibly be someone whistling or a child piping or some other sound of joyous, abundant life. There are other sounds that are still more vividly, particularly suggestive, things we might expect to find at a Russian Shrovetide fair. Here's someone playing a squeeze box, the kind of gigantic accordion the Russians called a bayan. Stravinsky imitates its mechanical sucking and blowing. Then there's something more alarming, disturbing even. A peasant is leading a bear on a chain. He's piping shrilly. Stravinsky suggests this by using two clarinets playing together. The bear's anguished bellows can be heard on a tuba. The bear clearly doesn't like it. And note how Stravinsky suggests at the beginning the terrified crowd quickly scattering. There are gentler sounds too, though even here Stravinsky manages to suggest a kind of abrasive clash, the kind of thing that happens when people get together in large numbers. First, here's a solitary organ grinder setting up his pitch. But then, a moment or two later, we hear a woman playing a bright, tinkling music box, and the two play together. Harmoniously? Well, up to a point. But the rhythms of the tunes, the clarinet from the hurdy-gurdy and the glockenspiel from the music box, are ever so slightly out of phase. Then there are other sounds that are far harder to specify, and the score doesn't always help. Take this rustling, murmuring, clucking accompaniment to a Russian folk tune on an oboe. Now, the score says that's the introduction to the wet nurse's dance. I better explain that rather grotesque-sounding term. A wet nurse was a woman who was called on to provide milk for an infant, usually the daughter or son of a member of the gentry who wasn't up to the task themselves or a little too fastidious to do it themselves. But the accompaniment, that warbling, murmuring woodwind sound, what is it? It could really be basically just a sound of life. Kind of thing Nielsen loved to create, or Sibelius, or Mahler. Those are composers who are often able to suggest a kind of natural vitality without exactly telling us what it is they're evoking, just the sort of throb or pulse of nature. That's one of the great things about music, its dreamlike ambiguity, its double or even triple-sidedness of its symbols. And of course, these aren't just musical images. There are also musical themes to be developed in musical terms. So there's also another kind of double aspect to the music. How much of it is storytelling or scene painting, and how much of it is just a piece of music, developed as a piece of music. Still, there'll be some of you who know Petrushka from the familiar 1947 score who might have noticed the odd unfamiliar element, particularly when it's relative to colour. Well, the BBC National Orchestra of Wales and conductor Thierry Fischer are not using the familiar score, but Stravinsky's original 1911 version. The orchestra behind me are significantly larger. We've got 16 woodwind instruments instead of 12, and there's a slightly bigger, more colourful brass section. More about that later. We've also got a second harp. Now, that does make a practical difference to the kind of sound, but it also affects some of those sound symbols we've just heard. Like, for instance, that rustling sound, that murmuring sound, with four bassoons and four oboes. In the familiar 1947 version, there's only three of each woodwind, so there has to be some mixing or doubling up, not to mention the added trumpets that Stravinsky adds in that passage. It's still effective, but the quality of the sound is different. I don't know about you, but I do miss that kind of smooth, warbling, pulsing sound of the original. There's a very special quality to that, hard to define, but very vivid. And do you remember that clashing organ grinder and music box passage we heard a moment or two ago? Well, there's an extraordinary sight in the orchestra, which is four hands squeezed onto one tiny Celeste keyboard. I can't think of another example of a Celeste duet like that in music. In the revision, Stravinsky takes out the glockenspiel and gives its tune to the Celeste, which is much reduced from its original four-hand texture. That in itself is transferred to some little arabesques on a harp. In concert piece terms, it's a lot clearer. You can hear the textures and the lines much more distinctly. But something of that flavoursome comedy, the clash of two different kinds of instrument, is lost. On the whole, these changes are pretty subtle, but they do add up, and some of them are more distinctive. Take, for example, what's probably Petrushka's most famous tune, a little fanfare melody for the entry of one of the principal characters, the puppet of the ballerina. Here's a taste of the familiar 1947 version. The ballerina's fanfare melody played, as it usually is in the revised version, on a trumpet. What about the original 1911 version? Well, one of our brass players has been changing instruments. In 1947, we've got the fairly conventional three trumpets. But in the original, it's two trumpets and two cornets. The larger brass section also has a stronger colour instrument, a colour contrast, therefore, at this high level in the brass section. Now, the cornet is often considered a more vulgar, brassy, or indeed sentimental sound than the much purer trumpet, much more thoroughbred instrument, you might say, in orchestral terms. It has what you might politely call a robust sweetness. Still, you'll note the change of colour when we hear that fanfare as originally scored for the cornet. We'll take it from slightly earlier, a little three-note call from the cornet. You can imagine the puppet meister calling out, "Cue ballerina." Many thanks to our trumpeter cornetter Philippe Schatz there for deftly making the transition from one instrument to another that looks very similar but actually isn't at all. In that version, the ballerina isn't so bright or pure as she is in the familiar 1947 score. She's slightly more brassy, you might say, which I think makes a rather nice point here. You see where I'm heading? Like a lot of people, I got to know Petrushka in the familiar 1947 revised version. When I discovered the original, it felt like another dimension of illustrative power or flavour had been added to this music. It's the kind of thing Stravinsky later turned his face against. Music of itself can express nothing, was the kind of remark he liked to make. But it seems he felt differently in 1911, and that's highly relevant to his original conception here. And as far as I'm aware, Stravinsky never said that the revision superseded the original. If any of you out there know differently, I'd love to hear from you, but as far as I'm aware, he never said anything of that nature. And it wasn't just the flavour or the atmosphere that Stravinsky changed. He made it slightly more, I think the word I'm looking for is anonymous in the revision. Something else he changed, more fundamental, and it affects the storyline. And for those of you who are wondering when I was actually going to explain the story of the ballet, here it comes at last. There's a kind of story within a story here, a scene within a scene. In the middle of all this crowded human life in all its raw Russian vitality is a puppet theatre. It's no ordinary puppet theatre. A magician comes on to the grotesque and slightly unsettling sound of bassoons and contrabassoon. There are some eerie washes of sound from the strings and the harps and the celeste. Then comes a kind of incantation, a spell on the flute. And weirdly, the puppets don't just seem to move, they actually appear to come to life.
Thank you.
the puppets brought to life there by our flautist Andrew Nicholson. In the revision, Stravinsky removed the second harp, and also the Glockenspiel, and toned down those washes of colour from the Celeste. It's hardly fatal, but it does take something out of that magic spell, I think. There are three puppets here. There's the ballerina, who we've already met to her brassy tune on the cornet, and there's the Moor, a stock villain. One mustn't forget that racism was entirely acceptable in 1911 in a lot of societies. And Petrushka, himself, well, he's a kind of sad clown puppet. His name in Russian means either Little Peter or Parsley, not exactly dignified. And as the music makes clear, it isn't exactly a dignified role that the puppets have to play now. All three of them enter to a kind of jerky dance. It doesn't sound quite real. Their strings are being pulled or jerked. Their movements are spasmodic, not exactly lifelike or human. Stravinsky uses the piano, his own instrument, to heighten that jerky effect. In fact, the piano is a very important soloist in Petrushka. There's some very beautiful writing for it, almost impressionistic in places, which is very untypical of the later Stravinsky, who liked to treat the piano as a percussion instrument. But in this passage, there's one solo which is very awkward to play. There are handfuls of chords in rapid succession, especially in this later solo passage. It's one of the most dreaded moments in the orchestral piano repertory. I'll ask our pianist, Catherine Rowe Williams, if she'd risk a brief demonstration. It may be dreadfully hard to play, but there's a brilliant sense there of that jerky puppet movement in that brief solo. We come to the end of the puppet show, but then it all begins to get rather strange. We enter the world of those 19th century masters of the surreal or the uncanny, like the German E.T.A. Hoffmann or the Russian Nikolai Gogol. We're not with the crowd now. The whole mood of the piece seems to take on a much more dreamlike character. We're looking into the cabinets within the theatre where the puppets are stored. A door is flung open, and Petrushka is booted onto the stage. The door closes quickly behind him. Each movement is registered brilliantly by one of those wonderful Scott Bradley scores for Tom and Jerry. Can't you just see it all there? I can. Now comes a very important motif on trumpets and cornets together, muted. They shrill out the motif of Petrushka's curse. We certainly get the message there, don't we? Interestingly, it's just that bit shriller with trumpets and cornets, instead of just trumpets in the revision. Petrushka curses the boot that kicked him, and with it all the other forces that treat him as just a puppet. But this puppet is alive, with real, powerful feelings. We learn more about these feelings when the ballerina saunters in. There are two very simple, almost nonchalant bars on the piano, and Petrushka is inflamed. There's a big crescendo. Then, as the ballerina leaves, the solo clarinet registers Petrushka's anguish. Again, we get the picture. There's real pain in that clarinet outburst, and it's underlined in the original. The notes for the clarinet and for the orchestra in that final poignant outburst are almost exactly the same in both versions. But in 1911, there's a marking, largamente, and also lamentoso assai, very lamenting. But in 1947, there's not even a hint of lamentoso and no largamente, no slowing down. Stravinsky even quickens up the last two notes. He changes them from quavers to semiquavers. It's as though the older Stravinsky's saying, don't linger, don't make too much of this. And whereas in the 1911 version, the tempo is left to the clarinetist, there are no bar lines at all and the conductor doesn't beat, in 1947, bar lines are imposed on the music. The clarinet has to follow Thierry Fischer's beat. The effect is quite different. Stravinsky seems to have wanted it more metronomic, more like this. This change, this regularising, this making the music more regimented in the 1947 version is very much of a piece with Stravinsky's later pronouncements on objectivity in music. We've heard him say that music can express nothing. He set his face firmly against all kinds of interpretation in performance. He insisted that he wanted his own music conducted like a metronome, as we've just heard in that revised clarinet cadenza. Many thanks indeed to our clarinetist Robert Plain for realising Stravinsky's 1911 and 1947 versions so effectively. He seems to have wanted to eradicate from that clarinet passage any kind of interpretative bending of tempo, and the conductor has to be there to keep him in line. It keeps the action safely stylized, artificial, unambiguously puppet-like. No corny invitations to identify with the poor forlorn puppet. But in 1911, Stravinsky clearly thought differently. He wanted pathos, like in his old score of The Firebird. Someone's found a piano score which is absolutely covered in emotional instructions to the conductor. That was only the previous year to Petrushka. Clearly, the older Stravinsky wanted to forget that he ever thought or felt like that. But the original score reminds us that he very definitely did, once. There's a similar change in expression in the passage just before, when Petrushka is left on his own after the ballerina's entry. There's a touching little piccolo and piano tune. In the original, it's marked dolente, lamenting, weeping almost. But in 1947, there's the much more neutral espressivo, expressive. And it's still more striking when we see the ballerina and the Moor dancing together, heightening Petrushka's pain and rage. In 1947, it's a trumpet and a flute. In the original, it's that brassy cornet and the flute. 1947 has the marking ben cantabile, well or nicely singing. But in the original, it's cantabile sentimentalmente, sentimental singing. Here we have a registration of Petrushka's emotional disgust, though as in the revision, it begins with the same limping bassoon accompaniment. It's almost as though we're invited to feel Petrushka's revulsion there at the sight of those two dancing together. Inflamed by this, Petrushka attacks the Moor, but the Moor easily wins and throws Petrushka out. Darkness falls along with the curtain. And suddenly we're out in the Shrovetide Fair again, with all those sounds of teeming, milling life. There's much use of Russian folk tunes here, some invented, some actually quoted, originals. The music builds to a huge climax. There's a sense of life almost bursting at the seams. The primal energy is almost too much. There's an ecstasy, if you like, in a kind of ancient pagan sense. We're looking forward here to the next ballet, The Rite of Spring. Listen to the way that Stravinsky exploits this particular folk tune. We'll hear it first of all played on its own by the violins and the cellos. Stravinsky combines that in a kind of elemental canon, an imitation between the cellos and the violins and the trumpets and cornets, with more of that whirling, murmuring, pulsating sound of life in the background on our full 16-strong woodwind section. Energy is terrific, exhilarating, and almost scary. We are close to the rite of spring. And this primal energy releases something dark, maybe. Something dark in humanity, dark in the crowds assembled. A mummer, dressed as the devil, runs into the crowd, who begin to play along with him. There's a feeling that things could just get out of hand.